Actor and comedian Joe Piscopo discusses his legendary career in his terrific new memoir, Average Joe. Plus, creator, director, and executive producer Dallas Jenkins of the newly released season 5 of The Chosen, Last Supper, joins us. The World Open begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. A great show for you this evening. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. And on YouTube, I'm at Arroyo Grande Show. He's a comic actor, a master impressionist, star of numerous classic comedies, not to mention an early 80s cast member on Saturday Night Live. He's also the author of a new memoir packed with behind-the-scenes stories about his incredible life in showbiz so far. It's called Average Joe, The Memoirs of a Blue-Collar Entertainer. Here's my exclusive interview with the vice chairman of the board, my pal, Joe Piscopo. Joe, thank you for being here. I'm delighted. You're going to tell that story later about why I called you vice chairman of the board. But tell us how you got into this business, Joe, and who your first inspirations are. I thought it would be Sid Caesar or Milton Berle or somebody, but it wasn't.
Yeah, very close. And Raymond, honored to be with you always. Sure. Really, really always an honor to be with you, dear friend. And thanks for reading the book. I appreciate that very much. But, you know, the funny thing is when I was a kid in Bloomfield, New Jersey, and we'd be watching the Ed Sullivan Show, and I just could distinctly remember, third grade maybe I was, and there was a guy, and this is really esoteric.
Okay.
So stay with me if you would. There was a guy named Guy Marks, and he was a comedian out of Philadelphia. And he would do like bits. And also a guy named Frank Gorshin. These guys would do bits. They would set stages and say, what happens if this guy, if Humphrey Bogart, walks into a bar? And say, I was mesmerized by that. Jerry Lewis was always my icon, and you doing the greatest Jerry Lewis interview ever. You know, that's show business legend. We all know that. So Jerry was like a hero to me watching The Nutty Professor back then.
Yeah.
But these guys and Ed Sullivan doing characterizations, that caught my eye. Not the Alan Kings, not the Milton Berles, not the stand-ups, uh-huh. The guys that would just do characterization. Isn't that funny? I got sucked right into that.
Yeah, and they were kind of impressed. I mean, Frank Gorshin was a renowned impressionist. Of course, people know him from the Riddler on the old Batman show, but he was much more than that if you've ever seen his act, you know. But you say you weren't a comic, Joe Piscopo, but why were you in comedy class?
Yeah. Well, just to get a platform to become a working actor. So when I went and I got out of college, and my father, God bless him, rest his soul, was an attorney, and I knew I should have gone to law school. He could have probably got me into law school, and I would have been in with him in Jersey representing, you know, the blue collar workers like Pop did. And I said, let me try the comedy thing because Ray, I didn't want to like get to an age and say, geez, I wonder what would have happened if I ever did that. So I said, I got to go to the comedy clubs. Let me get on stage. They could see me. And then all I wanted to be is what I am now, just a working actor. Are you working? It's about working. It's about the journey. Never wanted to be a star. Never wanted to be a stand-up comic. So I went, I put like 5 minutes together, went to the improvisation, 1976. When New York was really rough. You think it's bad now. It was really rough back then. And the story goes, as I said in the book, it was true. I said, let me try audition night, Sunday nights. And I went in and I went through the Lincoln Tunnel and went around 8th Avenue, came down 9th Avenue, 44th and 9th, the legendary improvisation comedy club. Audition night, there must have been 300, maybe 400 people waiting to get into audition.
400?
And I looked at it. I had to be hundreds of people lined down 9th Avenue. Right. And I looked at that line and I kept going, went right back in the Lincoln Tunnel, and I went back home and chickened out completely, you know.
Tell me how Ann Mira and Jerry Stiller mentored you. You mentioned that in the book.
Oh, the best. I just saw Ben Stiller, and I just told him how Ann and Jerry were such a big influence on me. So after a while, when I went back, we would have to get there at noon to audition. And then at 8 o'clock, I remember everybody, Judy would come out, she'd hand the numbers out, and we'd get on stage. So you do audition after a while. And then Chris Albrecht, as you read in the book, was the guy that made me a regular at the Improv. Meant you had to hang out in the dark, dingy bar till 2:30 in the morning and play before like four drunk people. That was a regular, you know. But who was in the bar? It was Stiller and Mira. It was Anne and Jerry, and they were there, and they could not have been nicer. They were just so kind to me, and they said, "Look, you gotta work." And then they said to me, "You gotta do the commercials." I said, "I could do commercials? Yes. Somebody will come in. They'll see you on stage. You'll be able to do commercials and make money, and that's the money. So if you make money doing commercials, you can really do what you want to do in your career." And they were really influential. Could not have been nicer. We were scared. We were all scared back then.
Yeah, of course.
And Anne Amira particularly was so nice. They were sweetheart. They gave me the best advice. You want to do commercials, you'll make money, so you could go like this. You remember this, the Italian thing?
Yeah.
You could do what you want.
Yeah, and Larry David was also a comic at the same time and a writer. Was he on SNL when you were there?
He was for a minute. And he was like, let me tell you, back in the late 70s, at the comedy scene, and thank you for bringing it up, Ray, the comedy scene, it was like when comedy became rock and roll.
Right.
It just caught on. I don't know if it was Freddie Prinze Sr., whether it was Rodney, whether it was Robin Williams, it was Robert Klein. Whatever it was, it was a perfect mix of, oh, my gosh, comedy is hot. Everybody had to do comedy. And so that's when I went in there, and there was Larry David. Larry David was there. And Larry had been there a couple years prior to when I went in.
Yeah.
So now Larry he would go on stage and he would get into fights with the audience. Right. He would get into what you see on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Yeah. That's Larry, man.
Yeah.
He'd be and we would all gather by the little hallway that led to the showroom, from the bar to the showroom. Hey, yeah. Larry's on. And you go, Larry, back and forth with the people. And it was, you know what, though? It was comic genius. You could see it was comic genius, you know? But I've never seen him do a full set because he would always leave in a huff. It was so great to watch. Back then, you know.
He'd leave in a huff. Yeah, look, we have mutual friends, he continues that routine today, Joe. But look, tell me, leaves in a huff. Tell me what you learned when I read in the book about Rodney Dangerfield. He was the first comic I ever saw live. I was 11 years old, and I begged my mother to buy tickets to two of his shows back-to-back in New Orleans. And I sat in the front row. He insulted me for half of it. It was fantastic. What did you learn from Rodney Dangerfield?
Well, Rodney was a sweetheart, and he would come in, and I was the MC at that point.
Right.
And so I'd be on the stage at the Improv, and you could see the shadow of Rodney in the back light, in the back room, and I'll never forget this. And Rodney, I'll tell you, sweetheart, great guy, and blew that room out like nobody else. Rodney killed it. Pryor came into that room. All the greats came into that room. Nobody blew that room out, the improvisation, 44th and 9th, Hell's Kitchen in New York, late 70s, like Rodney. And we would watch him mold his set to go on The Tonight Show. And then we'd be in the bar, you know, on a weeknight, and we watch Rodney do his brilliance. So I saw his shadow, and I went, whoa, it's Rodney. So I say, being a kid, I don't know about that, I'm on stage going like, hey, Rodney Dangerfield is here. And the crowd goes nuts. They go nuts. And I go, Rodney, come up on stage. Come on. And like that. I go on stage. There's a pause. There's a little pause. I go, Rodney, come on. Rodney finally comes up, does a killer set. After the set, we go back to the bar, and he says to me, and he comes over. He goes, Joe, you're a good kid. You're a good kid. I like you. You're a good kid. You're okay. You're all right. You're okay. And I'm looking at him. I go, thanks, Rodney. He goes, but you don't introduce me like that. You got to do it with respect. I'll tell you. And he's telling me how to do it with respect, the man who gets no respect at all. You know? Is that wild? So in my mind, I love when you're on the air, Raymond Arroyo. You're so polite and you're gracious when you come on our radio show, and when you're doing national television or your 350 million homes that you go into on EWTN. That is such a testament to your character, by the way, if I may. But I learned from Rodney, and to this day, everybody who comes on my radio show, look who's kind enough to join us. Would you be so kind to welcome?
When I read that, I thought, you've never forgotten the lesson. You do it every day, Joe Piscopo, on your radio show. Because, you know, you'll book me for a 10-minute slot on the radio show. 5 minutes is just introduction. So, you know, which I love. Look, it means less work for me. I'm happy. That's why whenever they call, will you do the show? I say, yes, Joe, I'll be with Mr. Piscopo. You bet.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
I love it. Look, you get booked on the Merv Griffin show. How big a break was that? And tell people how that led to Saturday Night Live for you.
Yeah. Well, you know, so we're at the club, and then people would the Tonight Show was one thing. That was the high bar.
Yeah.
And that was Rodney, and that was Robin Williams, and that was everybody, and Pryor, certainly. So now Merv Griffin had a show, and it was a big show, syndicated all around the country, as you know. Mm-hmm. So now people were getting picked up on Merv's show, and Merv's people came to me and said, we'd like you to do 5 minutes. I'm thinking, I'm not a stand-up comic. I'm just up here trying to get a job as an actor, you know, so I can keep working. They said, put together 7 minutes. And then I go, great. They brought me out to L.A., and it was right there in Hollywood. And Merv, a real sweetheart, a great guy, as you know. And it was weird because I was backstage, and then I heard, you know, hey, please welcome new comic from New York, Joe Piscopo. And I came out, and then I remember in the clubs, this is the little things I remember, one of the comics said, look, the cameras are high, the audience is low. If you are low, you're not going to be making contact with the camera. Keep your eyes to the camera, which was great advice. Wow. You see how we used to talk back in the clubs then? It was all a great learning process. So I'm doing my bit, and the audience is laughing, and I want to go into the crowd, but I stayed, and the hit was really good. Now Saturday Night Live is ending its run with Lorne in the original cast, and they're looking for new talent. They sweep all the comedy clubs. They sweep, and you know what? No one gets nothing. Nobody hears anything. Oh, maybe there was a guy named Richie. Maybe Richie got in. Nobody got nothing. So now I had a friend writing with Gene Domanian, who they put in to replace Lorne Michaels, and she needed a utility guy. And my buddy, who was writing, John DeBellis, goes, hey, Joe Piscopo does impressions down at the Improv. Why don't you bring him in? I go up to the 17th floor. I do an audition for Gene. She loves it. She goes, come to the audition when we have everybody in. And now that was an honor, and to be able to do that. I must have bypassed 5,000 people who everybody wanted to replace the original cast. I didn't want to replace the original cast. You couldn't replace the original cast. No. It was Gilda Radner. It was Billy Murray and Chevy Chase, Belushi and Aykroyd. You can't replace that cast. Yeah. So I went back and forth with my agent, with Chris Albrecht. I said, Chris, they want to see you. Don't ask me to do this. I can't do it. So the audition comes. I'm there. Paul Rubens was there. Pee Wee Herman was there. Gilbert Gottfried was there. We were all there auditioning. And there must have been hundreds of people. And you know what? I could care less because I didn't want the job. So I think that's why I got hired. Right. I was so flippant. I did Sinatra. I was calm. And they probably thought, hey, this guy, if he's calm now.
Yeah, he'll be great.
You know, they made the offer, and I still didn't want to do it. But then my agent said, you're doing Saturday Night Live. You got to do it.
Wow.
And we did it. And the first 10 shows weren't easy. I'll tell you, they were tough, you know, the going back and trying to replace the original cast. Almost an impossible task, my friend.
But you're paired with so many incredible people. You and Eddie Murphy particularly are the standouts of that second cast. What was the key to that chemistry that you two had, Joe?
Yeah.
Tell me about the timing.
Ray. It's like, you know, I just saw him at the SNL 50, and there's a connection there. But Eddie has that connection. He's a magic kind of person where he has a connection like that with everybody. So, but I remember they called me and they said, we got a young kid from Long Island, and he's a comic, and we want you to read with him. So I went back up to 17th floor. Now, I had been hired at that point. I believe I was hired at that point. And I went up, and there's a kid, young kid, 19 years old, from Long Island. Never heard of him. He was, because the Long Island clubs are one thing. Manhattan clubs were something else, you know? And I said, hey, he goes, meet Eddie Murphy. I said, Eddie, how are you? Joe Piscopo. It was like magic right there at that second. up in the 17th mm-hmm. floor. I remember exactly where he was seated. I remember the chairs. I remember the location. And you just connect. Some people you just connect with, and he was one of those. And I think a lot of people will tell you that about Eddie Murphy. But then they had us read. They said, you and Eddie got to read the word association sketch that Richard Pryor and Chevy Chase did, you know, where they went back and forth, very politically incorrect.
Yes.
So now now you got suits in the room, right? You got suits in the room. And you got the producer, and you got the writers, and you got the suits from NBC. And I'm reading the Chevy part, and Eddie's doing Pryor. And Eddie's to my right, and I'm reading it, and he is crushing it. He's crushing it. He's 19, and I felt the energy. I felt how, I said, this kid is like a comic genius. Like, you could just know it. You just knew it. Fluent, not a reckless abandon, and I knew right there. And I said, Eddie, hold on a second. So I went in and talked to Gene Domanian, and there's some NBC executives, and we closed the door, and I said, and I was with my buddy DeBellis, too, and we said, this is the next Pryor. You got to hire this kid. NBC wouldn't do it. They thought he was too edgy. Is that the wildest thing?
Wow.
You know? I said, I know. Teddy was too edgy. So they made him a featured player. So the first Ted show, you will see Eddie in these nondescript sketches. But then he goes, this was the key, if I may, where he goes, I want to do a sketch. I go, what are you thinking, man? And we just, again, the friendship was there. What do you think? I'd go out to Long Island. We would hang out. He goes, I want to do a sketch about a guy who's in the NBA and say there should be no white people in the NBA. And I went, that's hysterical. Can you make that? So I go, come on, Weekend Update. I'll do the sports guy. Hello again, everybody. Joe Piscopo live, Saturday Night Sports. And you sit next to me, and Eddie and I work our way in to the Weekend Update desk. We put him on phone books so he looks taller than I. Crushed it, and the rest, as they say, is history. He just crushed it, and he ran with it.
Tell me about the Sinatra and the Stevie Wonder sketch, an all-time classic.
Like I said many times, you are truly a wonder.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
But where did that originate, Joe?
At a piano upstairs on the 17th floor. And the song came out, Ebony and Ivory, and Eddie and I were at the piano, tinkering around the piano, saying, you know, we should do our version of this. You should do Stevie. I'll do Frank Sinatra. And we turned it over to our key writers, Barry Blaustein and Dave Sheffield. And they wrote it. And we had read-through. And it was, I couldn't tell you exactly what it was, Raymond. But it was, to me, my duty doing the Frank Sinatra impression was protecting the Sinatra name. Yeah. I never wanted to be rude. The sketch was a little too edgy for me. So I cleaned it up. And we went and we tried it. And I remember mounting it, and it just felt so comfortable because Eddie would do, he did a killer Stevie Wonder.
Hilarious.
Me doing the Frank Sinatra. And I don't know that you would get that through read through now. You are black and I am white.
Swing it, Stevie, with a bounce, baby. You are black. I am white.
And then the one time I upstaged Eddie Murphy ever, the one time only, you are blind as a bat and I have sight. I was like, oh, my God. It was so over the top, by the grace of God.
And right in character, Joe, right in character. Look, we'll talk about Frank Sinatra in a minute, but let's talk for a moment about being Italian. I know it's very important to you. Your dad, who was a lawyer, had a credo. Tell me what that was and how that Italian family you grew up with really shaped everything that was to come.
Yeah, you know, my grandparents came from another country, as you know, and they worked so hard. They could barely speak the language. And when my father first went to school, he couldn't even speak English, you know. And I got to tell you, I went back to the school at what is now the Roberto Clemente School in Newark to speak with the kids, you know. And I went and I told these kids in a Spanish class, they didn't speak a word of English. I said, well, my father came to this school. He couldn't speak English either, you know. And I'm telling you, so they went. He learned the language. Not only did he learn the language, he went on to skip two grades at that school, and he went on to become an attorney to represent the non-English-speaking blue-collar laborers that his parents were. My grandparents, they would talk. I can't believe what they went through. So at Pop, I don't know how to describe it. My mom, too. There's no rewards for being parents or coming from another country, learning the language, loving America. My father loved this great country. Everything I do on the radio, it's my parents, you know? But when my mother just passed away last year, rest her soul, you know what? They don't get a plaque. They don't get a trophy. They don't get, like you and I, we always get acknowledged by an organization and we do a speech and we go, thank you. We take the plaque, we put it on our office. Yeah. You get a little plaque. Nothing. My parents, nothing. Yeah. They just did what they wanted to do onward and forward. My pop served in the United States military. Here's an Italian family that came from Italy. Now, Mussolini starting the war. Where do they send? My grandparents would say, look, we're Italian. You're not going to fight against the people in the villages. They sent my father as an Italian-American over to Italy to clear the villages where he was brought up of the Nazis that were in there and to put the bombs on the plane of the B-24s and the B-17s so they could bomb the heck out of Berlin. And I'll tell you what, that is a legacy that I will never match.
Tell me your father's credo.
What, onward and forward? Onward and forward like that?
Yeah.
It was just like never say die, always, you know, always keep going. And the fact that he always, this is my father in a nutshell. It was his funeral. We were talking about that, his funeral. It was the wake. And there was some guy at his coffin as it was laid out. And the guy had, you know, you could see dirt in his fingernails. He had his jeans were all dirty. And he looked like he just came off the site, the work site. And I said, can I help you? And he goes, no, I just wanted to pay respects to your dad. He goes, I got hurt on my truck. And no one got me money. I was down and out. I had nothing. And your father took my case to court and he won. And I'm here to pay my respects. That's my old man right there.
Wow.
You know what? That's my father. Onward and forward, though. No matter what you go up or down, in and out, you know. And if you read in the book, I don't want to hold it. I don't want to, you know, go on and on now. But he got shot by some crazy person. He was shot 3 times in the arm, the stomach, and the leg while he was an attorney, you know. And he gets hit. And it was in Passaic, New Jersey in 1961, Ray. And he leans against the building, and all his friends came over to him. And it was just an arbitrary, crazy, you know, shooter. And they said, Joe, are you okay? To my father, Joe, are you okay? What can we do? And my father hands him his briefcase and says, you better cancel all my cases for tomorrow. I don't think I'll be able to make it, you know, like that. You know,
onward and
great
forward.
Great sense of humor.
Onward
Boom,
and forward.
Like that, man.
Joe, your mother sent you to piano lessons, which led to your first onstage appearance. Tell me about that. Tell me about the first time on stage.
Ray, Mrs. Gimble. And somebody called on my radio show the other day and said, I remember Mrs. Gimble. They were friends with Mrs. Gimble. She was from Glen Ridge, New Jersey. She was my piano teacher. I wanted to play baseball with Johnny Vargo, with Johnny LaBadia and Kenny Russo. We had a little Rat Pack in sixth grade in Bluefield, New Jersey, you know? I said, I want to play baseball. And Mom said, you're going to take piano lessons. I said, Mom, please, I want to go on. And so I took piano lessons, and Mrs. Gimble, she used to keep time on my shoulder like this, boom, boom, boom. And I learned everything, and then we used to have these recitals, and then where the parents come, you know, at the end of the whole you know, music season. So we had a recital. We had to do like a Mexican theme. So they had sombreros, you know, and it had we had a fake donkey on stage. We went big time back then. So it was like so we did our little Mexican thing, whatever it was, and then we went backstage, and then Mrs. Gimble goes, oh my gosh! I go, what's the matter, Mrs. Gimble? I'm in third grade. What's the matter? He goes, we left a donkey out on the stage.
Oh.
We left the donkey. I go, I don't miss a beat. I go like this. I got it, Mrs. Gimble. I go get the donkey like that. So I walk out on stage, and there's a full crowd. And I walk out. I looked at the donkey, just me, and I did this on stage. I said, hey, what are you doing? Like that. And I'm third grade with this, you know. Place broke out in immediate laughter. There was my comfort zone. That's where I found out in third grade. This is what I got to do. It's like addictive, kind of.
Yeah.
I felt it. And to this day, the comfort zone is like on camera. The comfort zone is on stage. I think you feel the same way, Mr. Arroyo.
You guys wore ties. I can't believe it. Yeah. Very hip guys. Hi there. How are you? Nice. I wore a tie to a TV special. How are you? It's prime time. We like to keep it clean. You know what I mean?
This is a very important question, Joe. Where did you first see or hear Frank Sinatra?
As my father would take us to school every morning, God bless him, And when we, again, we switched, we went to a different school, and he would have to drive us about 20 minutes up to the school. And he had, on the radio, was always Francis Albert Sinatra, a gentleman by the name of William B. Williams.
Oh, yeah.
And he was the legendary radio announcer who actually gave Mr. Sinatra
the title,
the term chairman of the board.
Yeah.
That's right,
chairman of the board.
And I would listen. But you know what, Ray? You would dig this because you're great musically and you sing great. And I just love everything that you do, my brother, really.
Oh, you're very kind.
But I couldn't decipher between Vic Damone, Tony Bennett, or Frank Sinatra until I started listening in that car, which was a Chrysler 300 convertible, man. Robin Egg Blue with an engine that you couldn't make today, you know? And I would listen to the. That's where I got hip. To Mr. S was with my dad like that. And then my father goes, when I wanted to go into entertainment, he said, you want to be like anybody, use Frank Sinatra as your role model. I'm in Bluefield. When we went to Mario's barbershop, you know, we'd go in Bluefield, we'd go, and then you'd walk in, and there were two pictures, the Pope and Frank Sinatra, and Frank Sinatra was above the Pope in Bluefield. You know what I mean? So it was like, no disrespect.
That was like my family, too. Yeah, they always had, Sinatra always had the pride of place. Look, well, here's what amazes me, Joe. You were hesitant to do Frank Sinatra on Saturday Night Live. Why?
Oh, please. It was because I'm Italian, and he's Italian, and it's respect.
What, you thought he was gonna come visit you? What did you think?
No. You know what people say, you know? It's like, you know, Mr. Sinatra does not like what you're doing on TV. It wasn't anything like that, man. It wasn't like that. No. Hey, no, but it was like, I started doing the Frank Sinatra impression at improvisation. You would love this, too. Yeah. This is a bit you could do tomorrow. Yeah. It's like where I would say, Lady is a Tramp, but I wouldn't end the song. That's why the lady. And I kept going to annoy the crowd. Why the lady? Hey, that lady. It was very Andy Kaufman-esque.
You would milk the ending.
And it would be.
Like, yeah. Which was kind of Joe.
So that, yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
So now I did it on SNL and I did the impression at the audition, and I remember I said I love Mr. Sinatra. He says the word you, and I sang, I don't stand a ghost of a chance with you.
Come on, baby, it's time. It's time for you.
So they liked it. I go on and I do the impression. I wrote him a letter. I wrote Mr. Sinatra a letter through Mickey Rudin, his attorney at the time. Mm-hmm. This is not to be disrespectful. If it bothers you in any way, Mr. S, my father told me you're the number one Italian-American. I will cease and desist, you know? And you know what? I didn't hear anything. And I do once. I do it again. We do it again. And then, sure enough, I get an invitation in the mail, all golden boss, from the Friars Club. Mm. And it's an invitation to the roast of Dean Martin. Roast of Dean Martin. Who's the master of ceremonies? Francis Albert Sinatra. He's the man. And that's where he gave me the okay.
And that's when you first met him?
Yes. Yeah, it was Cabot made the introduction. Because I went in, and I do this bit on stage, but there was Sammy Davis Jr., you know, and Sammy was, what a sweetheart, Sammy. Mm-hmm. Hey, man. Yeah, man. And you never knew where Sammy was looking because of his eye. Yeah. Hey, man. It was like that. You know, but a sweetheart of a guy. And then Dean Martin, I saw there was, and I'm 28. I wasn't even 30 years old. And I'm among my hero. Angie Dickinson was there. Shirley MacLaine. Milton Berle. It was really great. So Cabot grabs me, and Dick's a great guy. Cabot's a great guy. He goes, hey, come here, Joe. I want to take you someplace. So he walks me all the way to the back of the room, a little private place. And then I had my head down. And as I tell the story, this is the way it happened. And I looked up, and there was Frank Sinatra right before me, as close as the camera is now, that close. And you look into the baby blues of Francis Albert Sinatra. He looks right down into your soul, man. I tell you what, you could feel the energy of this man. He was one of a kind. Mm. And he's right there. And Cavett goes, Joe Piscopo, Frank Sinatra. And I actually froze, you know, and we shook hands. And it was very nice. And I didn't know if he knew who he was. But I'm going to tell you exactly what happened. Yeah. Then later on the dais, this is the way it really happened. Yeah. I dramatize it on stage a little bit. But because, you know, you and I, we don't tell lies. You know, we go to confession if
that's
it
right.
happens.
Tell it
but,
straight,
you know,
Joe.
I'm going to be honest with you. So I'm on the dais. And then I, Frank Sinatra is down on the stage at the podium, introduces me. And when you hear the old man, Mr. S, as we affectionately refer to him as the old man, he goes, Joe Piscopo, this kid's great. He does me. He's Italian. Please welcome the vice chairman of the board, Joe Piscopo. Boom, like that.
Wow.
I go, whoa. So I go up there. Now I do what I did at the audition to Mr. S. Mm-hmm. He's to my left. D. Martin's to my right. I'm a kid, man. And Mr. S is right there, and he's got a Jack Daniels in his hand, and he's got a cigarette in the other, going, right? And now he's watching me like this, right? He's watching me like this. And I don't stand a ghost of a chance, and I go, with you, like that. And he takes a beat, and he goes like this. That's pretty good. So I take the moment to say, hey, can I call you Frank? And he says, no. Like, that was great. He said, hey. I'll tell you what, biggest laugh of the night. It's like, you know, you're good kid, but don't push it. Right?
I remember, and I'm aging myself, Joe. I remember watching Solid Gold, which I never watched. Frank Sinatra hosted, and Frank introduced you to do an impression of him on Solid Gold.
Yeah, in makeup.
Yeah, the whole
so
routine.
It was like, so I got the call. And when Frank Sinatra called, he would call, you never asked where you're going, what am I doing. Huh. You never asked that. If you got a call from, it was Susan Reynolds who called, his PR person, Mr. Sinatra would like you here, you go, got it. You just go, got it. And you're going to find, they send the plane tickets, they send the car. It was like a whole other era, you know? And we go, they go, they want you in makeup as Frank Sinatra, to Frank Sinatra. I go, you kidding me? So I bring Kevin Haney out, and then I got to the studio. I'll never forget. And then I went in the studio. I said, is Mr. S here? And he goes, yeah, he's in makeup. So I said, can I say hi to him? He goes, yeah, he's in makeup. The door's closed in makeup. I go over. I'm scared out of my mind. And I knock on the door. The door opens, and there's one of my heroes, Frank Sinatra, my father's hero. And he's sitting, he's got a members only jacket on. You know, he's got his elbow on the makeup chair. I remember he had his foot out on the footrest, and he had these really cool looking 1980s boots on, Ray. You know what I'm saying? It was the epitome of awesome coolness. The half boots, man. And he looked, and it was Frank. You know what he did? Again, what I learned from Mr. Sinatra? He jumped up. He stood up immediately as I walked in. I'm a kid. I stood up. Hey, Joe, baby, how are you? How you doing? And he said to the gal I was with, hey, is he wacky around the house? He used the word wacky, which I love. Yeah. Hey, is he wacky around the house like that? But, you know, it was respect, man. It was loyalty and respect and all the great things about the Italian-American heritage that my parents taught me, that my grandparents taught me. And there it was in the greatest entertainer for me of all time, Frank Sinatra. So, oof. And then I did him, as you saw, I did him to him.
It's hilarious.
And I'm alive to tell the story, my friend.
Yeah, that's right. And you survived. And I know our pal Jerry Lewis did SNL with you, and you all bonded. What did he teach you, Joe?
You know, Jerry, you are the guy. You are the guy that did the single greatest interview with Jerry Lewis. Ray, I tell you, that is credibility and that is legend, my dear friend. I'm not just patronizing you.
He was ready to tell the tale, Joe. I do think there's a period where people are just ready, and he was really ready then. And we did connect. It was like when you described the thing with Eddie earlier. There are people who just gel and you can't fake it. It's just there or not.
And he will see insincerity in a second, as you know.
Oh, yes.
The one thing I learned about Jerry had a sixth sense. And if he saw you were off a little bit, fact that he accepted you, it might have been Fanta soda? Is that what you brought
him? Yeah, I brought him.
The Irish soda?
Good memory. Yeah. Chris, my producer, who's still my producer, it was Jerry's birthday. I said, what am I going to get him for his birthday? So I knew he drank that awful orange Fanta, sickly sweet, give me a diabetic cold. Soda. So I went down to the whatever it was, the Giant or the supermarket near his house. I got a case of Fanta soda. We put a big red ribbon around it. And I walked into the house first time I met the man. And I said, well, what do you get the man who's got everything? I said, how about this? And I dropped it in front of him. And he laughed his butt off. And that was the beginning. That was it. I was in.
And thank you for that, man, because those of us who love him and cherish him as the genius that he was, but when he came on SNL and then, and this was how it happened, because he knew what a big fan I was, I guess, because I got word from security when he was going to host, and he was first coming up to the 17th floor at SNL, and they said, Jerry's on the way up. I got the lead from security, and so I started down the hallway to get to the elevator. I hear the elevator door open. I hear the great Jerry Lewis talking, and I go, Jerry! Jerry! Why? I don't know. It's what came out. Jerry! What do I hear at the elevator around the corner? Joe! Joe! We hugged. And it was a love affair. And here's one of your cinematic icons, you know, because don't forget, I'm a kid. I'm 9 years old, whatever I am, watching The Nutty Professor, and here he is in person. Could not have been more gracious. And me and Eddie and the whole cast, we had the time of our life. One of our greatest guests ever.
See, if you're going to do an impression, you know the best one, like when I was nine, you know what? I love to watch TV a lot. When Gilligan's Island was on, I love that.
I don't do that's the section of the character, Jerry. I don't do that.
Oh, you only do the straight?
The straight, Jerry, yes.
I was stunned reading the book that you were going to do The Nutty Professor, and he was going to direct.
Yeah.
And then Eddie ends up doing it.
Yep.
When I was young and used to watch Gilligan on the side, the habit, don't.
Yeah, is that the funniest thing? And I remember when we were in the room up on the 17th floor, and we used to get the 35 millimeter, and they would play the movies for us, like before, if a guest was coming in, they would, a guest host, we would say, so we're watching The Nutty Professor. And I said, Eddie, this is genius, what you're seeing right now. I'm telling Eddie this as a kid. And then Jerry says to me afterwards, Joe, we should do The Nutty Professor. You're going to love when I direct. We went out to Warner Brothers with Mark Berman. It became Priority One project. And I was in my glory. I'm going to do Nutty Professor. Jerry, you know, the younger guy, however it was. And then something happened where Jerry couldn't direct. Jerry wanted to direct. Jerry wasn't happy about it. And there went the project. And my heart was broken. The only solace I had was it went to Eddie, because Eddie and Jerry were very close as well. Mm. And it had to be done. But you know what? Between you and I, with due respect to everybody, that original Jerry Lewis Nutty Professor film, as you know, Raymond, it's Chaplin, man.
It's untouchable.
You know, genius, absolute genius.
Yeah.
Right?
Tell me, there's something, there's a serious part of the book I want to get into, and you talk about candidly about your cancer scare. And was it thyroid cancer?
Yeah. And thyroid cancer,
How did that, I know that led to your bodybuilding, which, you know, became kind of a brand for Joe Piscopo for a while, but how did it deepen your faith?
You know, great question, because I think when I was in high school, and I almost didn't graduate high school, and then I did, I somehow, my father helped out, and I graduated, and I made it on to college, and I went to church. Everybody was going to parties at graduation, and I went to Notre Dame Parish in North Caldwell, got on my knees to give thanks. But as I went on, I seemed to have lost the faith. You hear it a lot. I went to college. I was still there. But by the time Saturday Night Live, I kind of lost my faith. Hmm. So then when I was diagnosed through my brother-in-law, Dr. Haraldson, rest his soul, he was great. He found something. He said, you got something in your throat. We went and had the biopsy, and they said it could be cancer in your thyroid. And now I'm doing Saturday Night Live. Everything's happening just the way it's supposed to happen. You're starting to make it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And now what? You know what I did? To your point, right? I got kind of angry. You know, you get angry at God. Why is this happening? Because everything else is going so well. And then we went in. The way it happened, they took the biopsy. They said, it may be something. You got to go into surgery. I do the Saturday Night Live episode with Eddie doing Muhammad Ali, Billy Murray hosted. Remember like yesterday? Yeah. Got up the next morning, did a hit on NBC with Brian Gumbel on NFL Today. Went right into the hospital. They cut me the next day. They took it out, took half the thyroid out, and they said, you're fine, you're great. Then I have a friend, Dr. Rock Positano. This is wild. Don't forget, I'm fine. You know what I said? I didn't say, thank you, God. I went, of course I'm fine. Uh-huh. You know, what am I, 31 years old? I got this. I don't need it. You get cocky like that. Mm. Then my friend, Dr. Rock, says, send the tumor down to NYU. They do they cut into the tumor. Remember, you know, Paul Sorvino and Goodfellas with the garlic, you know, like that. That's the way I think. I'm thinking, that's what I picture my You know, well, I could joke about it now, but they found a medullary carcinoma. Ooh. It was encapsulated. That's a very aggressive form of cancer. Mm. So I went, what? So I got upset, and I really pulled away from my religion then, thinking, rather than saying, this is, you moron, this is a warning sign. Yeah. You're doing something wrong. Take it as a sign. And I took it as an offense, and I just lost the faith, and it took me a good 10 years after that to understand what I think God was trying to tell me, Ray. Mm. So in the long run, my faith is unwavering and unapologetic. Yeah. You can't, and I love when I talk to you and you talk to like-minded people who understand the presence of God, the strength of the saints as a Catholic, you know. But back then I missed it, man. I missed it. But, wow. But by the grace of God, they gave me a curate in 10 years after that, you know. And then I started to see, and my face really strengthened after
that. Well, goodness knows, you've made up for lost time, Joe Piscopo. On your radio show, you constantly talk about faith, and you cover issues of faith that, frankly, remain uncovered in many other parts of not only radio, but the media at large.
Yeah.
We could go on all day, and we will do this again, I hope, in person. But, Joe, I can't thank you enough for being here. And I have to say, Joe, people should listen to your radio show and your incredible Sundays with Sinatra that are, you know, must listen in the Arroyo House.
I love you, man. I love you. I love you being strong enough to stand up for what you believe in.
Thank you.
God bless you indeed, Ray Arroyo.
Thank you,
Godspeed, my friend. Honored to be with you.
Thank you. Average Joe, The Memoirs of a Blue-Collar Entertainer by Joe Piscopo is available at bookstores everywhere and online. This week on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down with Dr. Daniel Amen. He's a psychiatrist and founder of Amen Clinics. We talked about how to maximize brain health, raising mentally strong children, and how to avoid dementia. This is an important show. Take a look. I see a lot of parents, they never want to let their kids fail. And I guess the flip side is the drill sergeant parent. You know, you're not good at anything. You'll never amount to anything. What's the balance there?
Firm and kind. Whenever you don't know what to do, go to those two words. The best parents are firm. When they say something, they mean it, and they expect it to be complied with. But they're kind. I always say, think of the best coach you ever had. The best coaches notice what you do right, and they teach you so you can be better. The worst coaches, the worst parents, notice what you do wrong, and they never let you forget it. And so bonding requires time, actual physical time. There's an exercise in the book I love. It's called special time. 20 minutes a day, do something with your child wants to do. And during that time, no commands, no questions, no directions. It's just time to be together. If you're like, my child will never talk to me, it's probably because you're not spending enough time with them and you're not listening. And then active listening. Stop talking over them. Stop trying to cram, you know, the 30 or 40, 50 years of experience you have in their heads. They're going to pick up just by living with you what you think and what you know. Your job is to help them learn how to think. And you do that through listening, asking thoughtful questions, and not giving them the answer.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Dr. Daniel Amen is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts. Check it out and subscribe so you don't miss an Arroyo Grande episode. You can visit RaymondArroyo.com. All the links are there. And this is a really important show for your brain health. You know him as the director of the wildly successful streaming hit The Chosen. I recently joined him on the set of the show to discuss the release of Season 5, The Chosen, Last Supper. Here's my exclusive interview with Dallas Jenkins. I want to start with Left Behind, and you apparently haven't been left behind. Your dad is Jerry,
who
best known for the Left Behind series. What did he teach you, Dallas, about not only storytelling and an approach to storytelling,
but maintaining a franchise, which is the hard part?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I got a front row seat to a lot of things with Left Behind that parallel what happened with The Chosen. And because I was there, I was able to learn a lot. Now, yes, being raised by a storyteller helps, of course. But I also saw how the Left Behind series started very small, started to grow, word of mouth started to grow, and then all of a sudden it exploded. And it became the thing, right? And I watched him not get more self-involved or arrogant or proud or self-reliant. It was the opposite. He got more humble. He got more surrendered, more desperate for help. And that was the biggest thing. And as we've seen this happen with The Chosen, where The Chosen started from nothing and then started to grow and then all of a sudden exploded, I was able to lean on him a little bit and go, I feel unworthy of this. What is going on here? And he said, welcome to the club. You know, and I'm like, this reminds me of when you were on your knees this whole time during Left Behind, just asking for help to manage it. And yes, to your question, to maintain the franchise. And that's, I think, the only way is to lose the ego the whole time. If I can maintain this surrendered posture that I found right before The Chosen when I had a big career failure, and I was like, I just want to be in your will. I don't care about the results. Well, if suddenly when the results start coming in and you start caring, you're back to square one, and I, God have mercy on my soul if I go back there. So I want to follow in his footsteps.
Well, that surrender is a real strong theme, not only with yourself, with Jonathan Rumi well. Yeah. This idea, you know, you were kind of up against the wall. You had this movie that didn't do what you wanted it to do, fantastic movie, you were with a big Hollywood studio. You said at that time you did not want to be known as a Christian filmmaker. And yet, following that, you're making these small films for your church.
Yes.
How does that add up?
Well, some of it's about semantics and public marketing and whatnot. When you hear the term Christian film, Christian filmmaker, at that time, I was almost embarrassed by it because it brought with it a connotation.
Well, it brings a bias among some people who don't understand fully what it is.
Yeah, and they don't want to watch anything that's quote-unquote Christian or faith-based. It implies that it's only for a certain group of people, and it also carries with it the weight of a lack of quality in a lot of people's minds. I mean, the faith-based, I've been part of it for many years, and faith-based film world and TV world has always been a little bit behind, so I kind of wanted to distance myself from that. And but yet, I still had a very strong passion for Christ-centered projects. I just didn't want them to have this label slapped on them that said, this is not for you. I surrendered all that. You know, at the time, like you mentioned, I started doing these short films for my church, stories of Christ, but from different perspectives. This whole concept of not changing the story, but maybe telling it from someone else's viewpoint was an interesting way to kind of recharge the battery for those of us who've heard these stories so many times.
Well, there was something you said at one point. You said you equated your journey to the feeding of the 5,000.
Yeah.
How did that eternal math work itself out in your head?
Well, it didn't work itself out in my head. It was from somebody else. I was at home alone, literally drying my tears and my wife's tears as we were experiencing this career failure. And out of the blue, while we're trying to wrestle with this and wondering, am I supposed to be in this industry? And genuinely saying, maybe I'm not meant for this. Yeah. Maybe I shouldn't be doing this. I mean, this was not that long ago. This is in 2017. And God just put it on my wife's heart, Amanda, as clearly as if it was an audible voice. Read the story of the feeding of the 5,000. So, okay, we've heard this 100 times. Let's see what we can glean from it. What does God have for us? Mm-hmm. So we open it up, and we're reading the story, and we're noticing a few things we hadn't noticed before, such as the fact that Jesus wasn't surprised by their hunger. He's the one who had actually been talking for 3 days. It was actually his fault they were so hungry. He brought them to the desperation point that they were at so that he could satisfy the miracle that they needed. So that was notable, but we couldn't quite glean what he had for us from it, and the numbers weren't growing like they did with the feeding of the 5,000.
Right.
So we're thinking, maybe it's
that's not for us.
That night at 4 o'clock in the morning, while I am busy doing a post-mortem trying to understand everything and writing out a big memo, I get a message from someone across the world, literally in Romania, who just felt led by God out of the blue to just didn't say hi, didn't say hello, didn't say heard about your movie, just said, remember, your job is not to feed the 5,000, it's only to provide the loaves and fish. And I looked around, I'm thinking, did my computer record what I was talking about with my wife today?
That AI's getting real good.
Yes, I'm thinking, how did this person know what we've been wrestling with all day long? And I've met him since then. He was a guy I barely knew, just a Facebook friend. And he just said, God just put it as clearly on his heart as he had on my wife's heart. Tell Dallas, it's not his job to feed the 5,000, it's only provide the loaves and fish. So that has become my whole surrendered posture since that moment, is I'm focused on making the best loaves and fish that I can. We're sitting on this set right now. Mm-hmm. I'm filming right now, while I will be in a few minutes.
Yeah.
That's my loaves and fish. I'm not thinking about whether there's one person watching or 100 million people watching. I'm not thinking about whether I'm going to see a YouTube video that calls me a heretic or a YouTube video that calls me the greatest filmmaker who's ever lived. None of those things can impact the work. None of those things can matter when I'm making the loaves and fish. It's up to God to do the multiplication. I'm just here to watch it happen.
Feed them. Organize the people into groups of 50 and 100. Gather up 12 baskets to distribute the loaves and fish.
Where did this idea come from? The way, because you said it a moment ago, we've all heard these stories hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of times.
Yes.
Your perspective on it was that you would see Christ through the eyes of those he affected. And when I heard that the first time, I thought of Orson Welles. You know, Welles wanted to do a movie from the POV of Jesus, where you never see Jesus' face, just how he encounters everybody else.
Yes.
Is that kind of the conceit here of The Chosen?
Well, even with Orson Welles' idea, the idea was that Jesus is the perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that, I've seen it done many times, and it's fine, and I love seeing the Bible portrayed, but Jesus makes actually for not a great literary character. He's not a great protagonist. He doesn't learn anything.
No.
He doesn't change. He doesn't become better from being bad.
The character arc is kind of...
It's not boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy girl gets a girl back. Like you said, the character arc is here. And so I thought, if we were able to experience Jesus through those who were around him, including his enemies, and maybe if we saw Jesus through the eyes of those who actually met him when he was here in person, maybe we could be changed and impacted in the same way they were. And so you might identify with Mary Magdalene, you might identify with Nicodemus, you might identify with Peter, or in my case, you identify a little bit with all of them. But then seeing how they were impacted by Jesus and knowing their stories before they met him has really seemed to be the secret sauce.
This is part of a longer conversation, right? There's more clarity coming.
Let's give him some time, Andrew.
I love you.
I don't identify with Mary Magdalene. I just want to go on the record and say that, okay? Maybe Nicodemus or one of the others,
okay,
but
good.
Not Mary Magdalene,
all right, good
okay?
To know, good to know.
No demons cast out. Tell me about the process. I see you running around here. I know you were rehearsing, you're prepping scenes. You've got multiple stages here that you're working in, sound stages and standalone streets.
Whoa.
How does the process work of actually writing the episodes? I know you write with two other collaborators.
I mean, and we're writing right now. I mean, as we're filming season 5, in between setups, I'll sometimes go to my trailer and work on editing notes for season 5, notes on season 6 writing. Tyler, Ryan, and I are the three writers who write every word of the show, and we get together before each season. We plot out the major points, and we plot out the eight episodes, and then they write the first drafts, and then get them to me, and then I put my stamp on it, and that's the final draft of it. But that process doesn't stop. The train has left the station and isn't going to slow down anytime soon.
Tell me about this crowdfunding model, which is pretty extraordinary that you coined, but now you've gone to a nonprofit model. How is that working out? And B, do you have the money for the season you're currently shooting?
Yeah, all right, all good questions. So the nonprofit model that we're in now came about because the free model that we had, where watch it for free, choose to pay for it or not, and that worked great, but we're a for-profit company in that we have investors, we have to have long-term sustainability. But that model, our goal is to get the show to as many people as possible, but when less than 3% of the viewers are actually paying for it, it's tough to sustain.
Right.
And the show's getting bigger. And you know, you've got Actors Union and Writers Union struck, and the crew union struck. You have to, have to pay more. So the nonprofit model became the only way for us to have long-term sustainability. So it's working great. We're about to complete our financing for this season. The nonprofit Come and See has ensured, they've said, look, we're going to make sure you get to keep on schedule while they raise money. Wow. We don't have a big studio or network behind us saying, here's your, you know, we see this is going to work. We're going to write a big, you know, $500 million check to make sure you're good. We got to keep,
well, you I like
keep
it.
The
it's
fans
a walk
engaged.
Of faith, though. You know, I worked for a woman, Mother Angelica, who founded a network, and this is how she operated.
Yeah.
She said, Providence only moves when you move. If you don't move, he won't move.
Yeah.
That's
well,
the
my wife
scary
calls it the
thing.
Manna program, which is every morning we come out with our hands outstretched for our daily manna. Mm-hmm. And God told the Israelites, don't store it up. If you store it up and start saving it for a future, I will make it rot. He wanted them reliant on him, and I think he wants us reliant on him for this.
And that
as well.
Posture of, help me, I need help.
Surrender.
You've heard the critiques, and I've heard them too. There are people who love the story. Some say it's too colloquial.
Yeah.
Why is it so casual?
Yeah.
Did they really talk that way? Come on, Dallas.
Yeah.
You would say what?
I would say they were human beings like we were. Jesus, of course, is fully human, fully divine, I believe, in the hypostatic union, but it's very clear he was a Jewish boy born and raised in Israel, and there's no reason to assume that 2,000 years ago they acted like stained glass windows or statues. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we project onto them a formality that comes from our good, comes from a good place, reverence. We want to honor them, we want to respect them, we want to walk in their shoes, follow their steps. But I think the beauty of the story is that we're following the steps of people who were flawed human beings just like we were, needed a savior just like we do, had questions, doubts, and struggles just like we do. When you take that away and turn it into this formal, kind of distant thing, I think it actually not only hurts us and takes away from the power and causes some people, members who've, of the church or people who've considered Christianity and then rejected it because they're saying, I can't relate to this. I can't live up to these saints. And you're like, no, they were like you. They just recognized their need for a savior.
I've read a lot of commentary, critiques of the Chosen. Mm-hmm. People saying it works for this reason, it works for that reason. I want to know from you, why do you think it's resonating now more powerfully and frankly in a far larger way than when you started this project, when you first conceived it?
The timing of this has turned out to be somewhat transcendent. I mean, our culture globally and here in the States is more tribal than ever. We have drawn very, very strong lines politically, even gender, even spiritually. And of course, ethnically and nationally, we've drawn just these really strong lines. And the moment you step outside of that line, you must be playing for the other team and you're not one of us anymore. You say the wrong thing, you're done, right? This is exactly the time period that Jesus came into. He entered a time where there were national, spiritual, religious, gender, racial lines drawn. And when Jesus came, they thought, he's going to be here to fight the war, to win. We're going to dominate. We're going to finally beat our oppressors. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what a lot of people today are wrongly looking for. And what they actually need and what they're looking for without knowing it, perhaps, is that Jesus' message of there is one Savior, and it's him. And he's not here to actually win a war. He's actually here to start a new kingdom in your heart.
And to all present here tonight, may the light of the Paschal feast burn within you, that with heavenly desires and pure minds, you may attain the festival of everlasting light, the kingdom I am bringing into this world.
I think there's something about that that's resonating with people and told in this human way. I hear from people everywhere I go. It's so human, it's so authentic, and that makes them then open to believing it's true. Because it doesn't feel fake, it doesn't feel presented, it doesn't feel performed, it feels authentic and real and human, and that makes people think, man, that actually could have happened, and maybe I can experience the same change and the same surrender that they did.
Dallas, thank you for the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Season 5 of The Chosen, Last Supper, Part 3, directed by Dallas Jenkins, hits theaters Friday, April 11th. For showtimes and tickets in your area, you can visit thechosenlastsupper.com. The entire season will stream in June on Amazon Prime. That is all the time we have for now. Look, we're preempted on Holy Week, but I wish you a blessed Easter and Triduum.
you and your families, and I hope we'll see you again on April 24th. Until then, you can find me on Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube, and we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.